Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, April is Cancer Prevention and Early Detection Month. Jay Fox will speak with an expert about the importance of cancer screenings. He'll also have conversations about Central Ohio's water quality and a new travel warning from the USDA. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective,
Prevent Cancer Foundation has revealed new survey data. This comes during Cancer Prevention and Early Detection Month. The data shows that routine medical appointments and cancer screenings have dropped 10 percentage points year over year, and skepticism of the healthcare system has risen 38%. Here in Central Ohio, we face an elevated cancer incidence and mortality rate, so this is of extreme importance to all of us. Jody Hoyos is the CEO of Prevent Cancer Foundation and joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Jay.
Absolutely. So what did the most recent survey uncover about cancer screenings in the United States?
The 2025 Prevent Cancer Foundation Early Detection Survey found that only 51% of adults in the U.S. have had their routine medical appointment or cancer screening in the last year. And as you noted, that's a 10 percentage point decrease from 2024. So we're moving in the wrong direction.
And is that the case in Ohio as well?
We'd have to look and see on a state-by-state basis to see if we can pull that information. But it is a national survey, and we have representative populations across the country. So it's a pretty accurate assessment of what's happening.
I don't understand why people aren't getting screened. What's the problem?
Fundamentally, people often aren't getting screened because they don't know they need to be screened. That is particularly true for people who aren't experiencing any signs or symptoms, or people who don't have a family history of cancer. What we really want to make sure people know is that very often cancer in its early stages doesn't present any signs or symptoms. And the vast majority of people who receive a cancer diagnosis don't have a family history of cancer. So it's really important that everyone is getting their routine medical appointments, cancer screenings.
So when you go to your primary care physician for your annual visit or your semi-annual checkup, should you ask your primary, do I need to be screened for cancer, or is this something that they'll automatically tell you?
Oh, that's a great question, because that can present a big problem. People often assume their primary care provider, if they have one, so many people don't have one, will let them know what they need to be doing, and that is often not the case. So you should come prepared to have a conversation about the screenings you need and to talk about your particular risk factors. So whether you have a family history, whether you have a smoking history, those are really important in order to determine what you need to be doing. We have great resources at preventcancer.org as well to help people create the tools they need and the resource that they can print out and take with them to that provider's appointment.
Now, the statistic of 10% decline in screenings is disturbing, but even more disturbing is this business of skepticism of the healthcare system in general rising 38%. What is causing this?
That's right. So what we found was that 1 in 7 adults in the U.S. cited skepticism as the reason they skipped their routine cancer screening. So that is not what we want to see. And there can be many reasons for that. One of the drivers can be conflicting information, misinformation. People don't know what they need to do. They don't know what cancer screenings they need. They don't know how often they need to be going. They don't know when they should start their screenings. And that's a problem, and it can contribute to skepticism. So we need to make sure that people have the information they need. It's easy to find. It's easy to use. And can inform themselves about what they need to do and feel confident about that. Navigating the healthcare system can be overwhelming. We don't want that to be the reason why people aren't being screened.
Do you think people just aren't paying attention to themselves?
Oh, that happens as well. So we often, especially when we're caring for others and we're busy, we put our health on the back burner. it's not uncommon. And we here during April, Cancer Prevention Early Detection Month, and all year long want to remind people to take care of themselves. So put your health on the front burner. Early detection is really important as a tool to help you live a very long and healthy life.
I remember scheduling a visit with my primary a number of years ago, and I literally pointed out every blemish on my entire body that I thought was problematic. And the doctor laughed at me and he said, "None of these are problematic at all, but it's good that you came in and brought this to our attention. However, there is something on your face that I don't like." That ended up turning out to be a melanoma, which ended up having to be surgically removed. Had I not been so over the top about my health, I wouldn't have known.
What an amazing example. And I think, Jay, the important thing too, and just like you're doing now, is sharing your story, although it can be very casually, has a downstream impact. It's really important that we're talking about cancer screenings and sharing our own experiences. And in fact, we learned that 73% of people are more likely to schedule their cancer screening once they learn the benefits of early detection. And that often happens from a friend, a relative, or a voice they hear on the TV or radio talking about their own personal experience.
So if somebody wants to learn more about screening and what to look for and when and where they should go, is there a website that has that information?
There is. We have information about the screenings you need at every age. We have a list of free and low-cost screening locations, as well as a tool that you can personalize and print out to take with you to your provider's office. And that's all at preventcancer.org.
We want to thank Jody Hoyos, the CEO of Prevent Cancer Foundation, for being with us this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Up to 98% of Ohio's wetlands could lose federal Clean Water Act protections and up to $150 million in cuts to H2 Ohio. Central Ohioans share three main concerns: threats to drinking water, the loss of wetlands, and flood and pollution risks. Joining us now on Columbus Perspective is Melanie Houston from the Ohio Environmental Council. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay. Nice to be with you.
Good to have you. What are the main strategies used by H2 Ohio to improve water quality in Ohio?
Yes. Well, the funding goes to three key state agencies: the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, which is focused on investing in restoring and creating new wetlands, which serve as like the kidneys in our body. They help filter out pollutants and nutrients out of water. The Ohio EPA receives funding to support water infrastructure investment, so things like connecting folks with drinking water to their homes, home sewage treatment system upgrades, and replacing those old toxic lead water lines that still provide, you know, transport for drinking water to many people's homes in Ohio. And then thirdly, the Ohio Department of Agriculture, which provides funding for farmer incentives for best management practices, things like, you know, making sure they know, have nutrient management plans, so they know how much nutrients or fertilizers are going onto the soil and how much nutrients then, you know, go into the water. So the idea is, with all of these different programs, that we are keeping, you know, runoff from going, nutrient pollution from going into our rivers, which then, especially in the western Lake Erie Basin, those nutrients flow into Lake Erie and create these toxic algal outbreaks that we see chronically in our beautiful Lake Erie on our northern shore of Ohio.
Now, most folks that are listening today don't know that the H2 Ohio program is considered a national model for addressing water issues without relying on regulations. Why do you think that is? What makes the Buckeye State's program so special?
Yeah, well, it's really been the leadership of Governor DeWine in the aftermath of the what many of us refer to as the Toledo water crisis, where Toledo residents lost drinking water for a whole weekend in their community when some of the microcystin got into a water intake from Lake Erie in the aftermath of one of those toxic algal outbreaks that I was talking about. And so there was a lot of push at that time, you know, post-2014 to really come up with a solution, you know, a long-term program that would address these chronic algal blooms and improve our water quality, which we know impacts our drinking water quality in Ohio. And, you know, we thank and laud the governor for that. In 2019, this program started. It has 6 years under its belt. It's been, you know, providing fantastic benefits for Ohioans, because not only do these programs help to improve our water quality, but they also bring benefits for communities. When you think about restoring a wetland, you know, that's a resource that folks can go out and enjoy the beauty and the wildlife. And it provides, you know, so many more benefits than just the water quality benefits. It's also important in terms of, you know, costs. So when we invest in our water quality on the front end, that saves money for all of us on the back end in the longer term, because there are less costs that are needed to treat and clean our drinking water before it comes to our homes. So this is, like you said, really a model program, an innovative program in Ohio, and it's doing it by, you know, proactive action on the front end.
Can the Buckeye State survive alone on state, county, and municipal money, or do we really need that federal funding?
Well, we certainly need the federal funding as well. So what we know about water infrastructure in particular is that Ohio has a nearly $30 billion backlog. That's what we'll need to spend over the next 20 years to get up to speed on water infrastructure investments in this state, where we receive for our drinking water infrastructure, I believe it's a D grade from the American Civil Society of Engineers, Society of Civil Engineers, excuse me. And you know, that those federal dollars and the state dollars work in tandem with one another. So we need the federal dollars. We also need these H2 Ohio state dollars. And together, those programs, you know, add up for Ohioans. It's more efficient. You know, when these agencies work together, cross-coordinating, it's an efficient use and a good use of our taxpayer dollars to invest in our water. There's nothing more important and basic than clean drinking water, clean surface water, which leads to clean and safe drinking water for all Ohioans.
If folks want to learn more about the program, perhaps to volunteer or maybe even to make a donation, if that's a thing, where would they go?
Yes, that's a good question, Jay. The H2 Ohio program, I believe that being state funded, you know, taxpayer dollars, that's not a program that folks can donate in particular. What I would encourage folks to do instead is to reach out to their state lawmakers, particularly state senators. This is where the budget is, the state operating budget is currently being heard in the Senate, Ohio Senate, to be clear. And what happened in the Ohio House, where the budget starts, is that those House representatives in our state have just cut H2 Ohio budget dollars by nearly 50%. And what we want to see is that we go back to those original as proposed funding levels. When the governor first dropped his budget back in February, the program was funded in whole, you know, as it has been for the last 6 years. It's gradually inclined over time, but we want to see those levels as they were in the last budget cycle. And so the best thing for folks to do really is to reach out to their state senators, because the budget's going to the state Senate next, and we need to have those senators restore those H2 Ohio dollars to their full funding level.
Well, maybe you'll have the same luck as the libraries did. We want to thank Melanie Houston from the Environmental Council for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
African swine fever, otherwise known as ASF, is a highly contagious and deadly disease affecting pigs that has caused severe disruptions to global pork markets. While ASF is harmless to humans, people who encounter pigs or carry pork when they travel can unknowingly spread this disease. With Central Ohioans planning spring and summer vacations, the USDA needs our help to prevent the disease from impacting the U.S. agricultural industry. USDA Chief of Operations for the ASF ASF Incident Management Team in the Dominican Republic. Fernando Lugo joins us to discuss the issue. Fernando, how are you?
Good morning, Jay, to you and everyone.
Why is African swine fever such an important issue right now? We're just dealing with bird flu.
Yeah, and other than bird flu, that we're working really hard, USDA is working hard on the outbreak of bird flu. We are working also with the African swine fever, which is a very contagious virus that is killing pigs around the world. At this moment, as we speak, African swine fever has affected approximately 120 countries around the world. And when the virus was detected in the Caribbean in 2021, USDA decided to implement a protection zone in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. This with the intention of keeping the disease out of the U.S. It is very important that ASF does not create a danger or doesn't harm human health, but on the other hand, it is devastating to the economy and the world food supply. It is very important to understand that this disease doesn't have a treatment, doesn't have a vaccine. So prevention is the only way we can stop the ASF from spreading.
So we know that this is harmless to humans, but the traveler is the one who could potentially spread the disease. How does that happen?
Correct. You can unknowingly carry the disease with you. If you are carrying any pork products, you may carry African swine fever. Please don't bring any pork products when you travel back to the U.S. during this summer or spring vacation, visiting other countries. Please don't bring any pork products. If you are traveling outside the U.S. and you are intended to visit a farm, especially a pig farm, or you want to be around pigs, please try not to do so, because you can carry the disease, the virus, in your shoes, in your clothes. So please, if you have to do so, disinfect your shoes, clean your clothes, and declare to a CBP inspector upon arrival that you've been to a pig farm. Also, declare to the inspector any pork products that you are carrying with you entering the U.S.
What are some examples of those pork products that people would want to bring back anyway?
The people try to bring several products. It depends on the your culture, right? And one of the most famous products is the salami. That's very common. Also, bacon, pork chops, pasteles also have a piece of pork inside the pastel. So you may be carrying the disease with you if you're intending to travel with this pork product. So please don't bring any pork products. And it's very important to understand that this disease can survive extreme temperatures. This includes cooked or frozen. So you can have cooked food or frozen food, and the virus can resist and can survive these temperatures. Please don't bring any pork products into the U.S.
What happens, God forbid, if ASF reaches the United States? What would the impact be?
The impact is going to be humongous. The pork industry in the U.S., just to give you an idea, the United States is the second largest exporter of pork meat in the world. So the impact has been estimated in 10 years of around $74 billion. That's a huge impact. That includes the swine meat that is not going to be produced, but also job losses that we're going to have if the virus, the disease enter the U.S. And we understand that the culture of many people would be to bring any pork products into the U.S. And that's why we want to make awareness of the disease to the people, so they don't bring any pork products into the U.S.
If folks want to do a deeper dive on this and learn more, is there a website where they can get more information?
There is very valuable information in our website. Our website is aphis.usda.gov/store. Stop ASF. You can find very valuable information in our website.
All right. Fernando Lugo from the USDA, thank you for being with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
A major change to the way people register to vote passed the U.S. House of Representatives. The SAVE Act would require you to prove your citizenship in person to register to vote in federal elections. SAVE stands for the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act. This week, I heard from supporters and critics of the bill.
Under the SAVE Act, those wanting to register to vote would have to show documents in person that prove their U.S. citizenship, such as a birth certificate or U.S. passport. The goal is to prevent non-citizens from voting. The U.S. House passed the bill Thursday.
On this vote, the yeas are 220, the nays are 208. The bill is passed without objection. The motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
It now goes to the Senate, where Ohio Senator Bernie Moreno is a co-sponsor.
It's long overdue. It's going to clean up our elections and give, most importantly, people faith and confidence in our elections.
Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose said in a statement, "I'm hopeful the SAVE Act will create a sense of urgency in lawfully providing states with the federal records we need to maintain accurate voter rolls, particularly when it comes to citizenship status." But critics say it will make it harder to vote. They point to the millions of women and men who have changed their names after getting married.
This would mean having to ensure that your birth certificate and your passport match information that you're providing, whether driver's license or otherwise.
Beth Link with When We All Vote also has concerns about people having a birth certificate or passport on hand.
I think many people, whether in your immediate family or in your extended network, can think of some folks that may not have access to those documents readily.
I think it's extremely important that you have to show valid government-issued ID when you go vote. You need that for everything else.
The bill does not affect the upcoming May election, of course.
Please don't skip this election, because every election matters.
But Jen Miller with the League of Women Voters of Ohio worries about the impact in the next federal election in 2026.
Physically getting into the Board of Elections can be hard for seniors, people with disabilities, students, active duty military families that are overseas.
Voters we talk to think the current system works well.
So if somebody come out and tell me that the system is broke, then maybe I might consider it. But right now, I don't think it's broke.
I think it's an effort to control voting. That's what it is. It's to try to block as many people as possible for voting.
The House passed the same bill last year, but it died in the Senate, where they'll try again this year. We reached out to other U.S. lawmakers from Ohio about the SAVE Act. In a statement sent to 10TV, Democratic Congresswoman Joyce Beatty said House Republicans' extreme voter suppression bill, the SAVE Act, doesn't save anything. Instead, it seeks to silence the voices of millions of Americans, especially women, people of color, and low-income communities, by making it harder to vote. Congressman Mike Carey wrote, "The SAVE Act makes American elections more secure, protects Americans' ballots, and promotes greater confidence in the system." Carey also told me there are provisions in the bill addressing the concerns about name changes not matching birth certificates. We'll hear from him later in the show. Joining me now to discuss the SAVE Act and other election issues is Secretary of State Frank LaRose. Mr. Secretary, thanks for being here today.
Great to be back, Doug. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you again. Well, first of all, just why do you support the SAVE Act?
It's common sense. And it's unfortunate that this sort of fear-mongering from the sky is falling, Chicken Little crowd is you know, in the news right now. They're doing the same thing they did when Ohio mandated photo ID. They said it's going to be the end of free elections in Ohio. Of course, it didn't play out that way. Actually, we've seen increased voter participation since Ohio started requiring a photo ID. Same thing with the SAVE Act. It's common sense legislation to make sure that only American citizens vote in our elections. Now, some people say, well, that's already the law. It is already the law. This is about enforcement. This is about making sure that we can enforce that law. And one of the things that's not getting enough conversation from the SAVE Act is that it will make federal databases more available to us so that we can actually get the data we need to make sure that only American citizens are registered.
You always say Ohio elections are the gold standard in transparency, integrity, security. So why is this needed then if it's so good right now?
Well, I mean, we're always working to get better. Last year alone, we were able to identify hundreds of non-citizens that had tried to register to vote and remove them. Hundreds out of the 8 million registered voters is a small number. But we're not going to rest until we make our voter rolls as perfect as we can. And this is just the next iteration in continuing to protect our elections. Listen, voter integrity drives participation. People that know that their elections are honest want to participate in them. And the irresponsible rhetoric from people that are spreading this false fear, these really ugly lies about the SAVE Act, it's irresponsible because that's what causes people not to want to participate.
But what about the concerns about, you know, the names matching on the birth certificate and now, and then also having to show proof in person to register?
It's a complete exaggeration. So what we do in Ohio works really well, and the SAVE Act would make it better. What we do is we verify your citizenship based on your state ID or your driver's license number. If, for example, you're one of the very small percentage that doesn't have a state ID or doesn't have a driver's license, then we would require you to come in person to verify your citizenship. But most of us, we created that record of our citizenship when we got our state ID or our driver's license. And for 98% of us, that would continue to
be the case. So if you're registered already,
of course,
it won't affect. Okay.
Absolutely.
Now, you recently testified before the U.S. House Administration Committee. Was that kind of hand in hand with the SAVE Act? Yeah. The same issues?
I think this is my third time going to testify in front of House Admin. And part of this is that those members of Congress recognize how Ohio is such a gold standard leader in elections administration. That's why they invited us to do it. But yeah, it was a look ahead to what changes may be coming in 2025 and 2026. But it was also a look back on 2024. And the chairwoman of that committee wanted to ask states like Ohio, how is it that you all do it so well when other states continue to struggle?
Moving on from that, you recently announced new data dashboards that are posted on the Secretary of State's website. Last year, I believe it was last October or so, you rolled out the early voting dashboard that could show people how where the numbers were stacking up county by county, statewide, Republican, Independent, Democrat. Now you've got two new ones that have come out. Tell me about those and the reason behind them.
Yeah, this is part of our work following the Data Act passage in Ohio and the creation of our Data Analytics Office. I was the first Secretary of State in America to create an Office of Data Analytics, and they have been hard at work really taking all of this election data that exists that we pull in from each of our county boards of elections and putting it in a user-friendly graphic way where people can look at it and know what's happening with their elections. You can find all of this at ohiosos.gov, ohiosos.gov/data. And there are more to come because we're working on trying to make sure that Ohio's elections are the most transparent in the country.
And the current ones that you just rolled out are about election history, like results history over the years, and then also registrations currently. Now, registration for this election is closed now, but why those two topics?
Again, those were the ones that we were able to get together first. I think that they were maybe most relevant to people as well. As you know, we're deep into the early voting period for the May 6th election. You can look on there and see how many people have voted, how many people have requested an absentee ballot. You can look at it by county. That's interesting information. Voter registration, also important. And then the one that we just recently introduced this week, which is election history, you can look back over the last few years and see trends. Political scientists and normal citizens are interested in looking at this to see, you know, how are voting trends shaping politics in certain regions of the state or statewide as well.
I was at the Franklin County Board of Elections a couple times recently, and I was there several times, of course, during the presidential election. And there's just such a vast contrast in voter turnout. It was in the hundreds after the first week of this coming up May primary special election, first day for the presidential election. Just in Franklin County, it was like 4,300. Does it distress you that, you know, turnout is so low? And I know it's not really fair to compare a presidential election to this one.
I always say we won't rest until we have 100% turnout. So that means we won't rest. But the fact is that those even-numbered years when we elect governors and U.S. senators and presidents tend to get the most attention. It's talked about on TV and in the media. Unfortunately, when we get to those odd-numbered years, like 2025, when we do really important elections like municipal elections for mayors and city councils and local offices. We have a statewide issue right now for infrastructure investment in Ohio. And so these are things that really impact your daily life. But a lot of people just don't think about them. They don't hear about them. And so, unfortunately, those elections often do fly below the radar. But that's why we're working to spread the word. Listen, it matters who lives in the White House. We all know that. But what also matters probably more is who works at the courthouse or the schoolhouse or city hall. Those are the kind of elections that we're having right now. And as much as we have shattered records in those even numbered years, like 20, 22, and 24, you're right. The numbers tend to be low in those odd numbered years.
Obviously, there is a lot more media focus on those big federal elections, the national elections and things, but you touched on it here, but these are decisions being made that do affect people's daily lives on the local level.
Yeah. And so here's a pro tip. I run into people all the time that say, hey, I'm not going to vote this year. I don't vote in elections that are non-presidential elections. And I always want to know why. I want to sort of get to the root of that. Oftentimes, it's some version of, I just don't know enough. I'm not informed enough. And people don't want to guess. Here's the pro tip, though. In Ohio, you don't have to guess. You can request your absentee ballot. It'll get mailed to your house. You can sit there at your own kitchen table. And when you vote by mail from home, you're allowed to cheat on the test. You can actually flip open your laptop. You can call a friend. You can take 20 minutes, the time it would take you to organize your sock drawer.
Do some research.
And fill out a really informed ballot and mail it in and then track it at voteohio.gov/track so that you know it arrived at the Board of Elections.
And you can also find your sample ballot, your particular sample ballot pretty easily on the website
right
as well.
Right there at voteohio.gov.
All right. Secretary LaRose, thank you so much for your time. I do appreciate it.
Thank you, Doug.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
This week, I caught up with Republican 15th District Congressman Mike Carey for a wide-ranging interview. We talked about President Trump's tariffs, a bill to require you to show proof of citizenship to register to vote, two bills he's co-sponsoring to help seniors and working families, and the recently passed House budget resolution that sets the parameters for spending and cuts as the House negotiates with the Senate. I started by asking about the budget, extending the Trump tax cuts, and concerns about Medicaid cuts.
That's going to be up to the committees of jurisdiction. I mean, We just basically set a baseline number and we set a top line number. So what we of the committees of jurisdiction have to do is, as it relates to, the president has made some priorities. He wants to make sure that there are no taxes on tips. He wants to make sure there's no taxes on overtime. He would like to make TCJA permanent. But I think given the numbers that we have to deal with, I think making TCJA permanent is going to be difficult to do. We just simply don't have the numbers there.
What does TCJA stand for?
This is the Jobs and Tax Cut Act. Okay. This is Trump's signature piece of legislation, and that's what we're trying to extend in reconciliation. So those are the things that we are going to be working as soon as we get back. We've been working on it for quite some time. We just needed to have the instructions from the budget resolution as to what the number would be.
Why do you think it's so important to continue the 2017 tax cuts?
Well, listen, if we do nothing, I think the average American will see their taxes go up by 22%. I mean, that's a fact of the matter. We have a lot of things that we have to address. I think part of the big pay for was the SALT deduction, which are state and local taxes. Really important to the folks in New York, really important to the people in California and Chicago. And I just did a bipartisan tour with Brad Schneider in Chicago. He came into Columbus a couple of weeks ago. Talking to those people, their taxes are really high. Now, it may not affect Central Ohio so much, but when you're putting a bill together, these are the things that we have to address. But I think the bottom line is just, people are concerned about expensing, child tax cuts. There are a lot of R&D expensing, things that a lot of the small businesses and large businesses here in Central Ohio have talked to me about. So we got to get this done. We've got to do it in a fundamental way that we can make sure that we have the votes to get it out of the House.
There's been some concern raised. In fact, yesterday, a couple of Democratic representatives and union members raised concerns about the possibility of cuts to Medicaid.
Not going to happen.
Tell me about that.
I think the president has been very clear. He does not want to touch Medicaid. And a lot of people, Medicaid and Medicare, they think of as synonymous, but it's not. But there's, we're not looking to cut Medicaid. The president has been very clear with that. He doesn't want to hurt any of the social services. So I think, you know, people are raising this because they're seeing a number. I think there's a lot of other things that could be going on in terms of spending reductions. But Medicaid is, you know, I think there's a number of not just Democrats, but a lot of Republicans. I think there was a letter that came out from 12 Republicans that are not on the Ways and Means Committee or the ENC Committee. But many Republicans are saying, listen, we're not going to touch Medicaid. And you got to realize we have a very slim majority in the House. So you got to make sure that not only do you take care of, you know, all of the constituencies within the conference, but when you have 12 members sending a letter saying no Medicaid cuts, I just don't think that's going to happen.
What's your stance on the current situation with tariffs as it stands now, in particular this back and forth and the raising of tariffs between the U.S. and China?
Yeah, well, you know, listen, I think the China thing is one thing. I mean, because you got to look at what they've done with fentanyl over the years and what they've done to our country and the trade policy. I was glad to see the president take a pause, a 90-day pause. I think when we signed our crypto bill into law last Thursday, which was the first crypto piece of legislation that's ever passed the Senate and the House bipartisanly. But I had the chance to be in the Oval Office with the president. The president was talking. He's had over 60 countries that have already reached out to him. And again, I think he's using the tariff, as long as he's using it as a scalpel instead of a sledgehammer, which is what I think he's doing. I think the negotiation process will take place. Listen, we've been taken advantage of for many, many years. Workers over the course of 10 years or 15 years, I forget what the number is, over 90,000 factories in the United States have closed. You know, these are things the president ran on. And so I think that what he's doing with tariffs is the right move at the right time. And hopefully he can negotiate a better deal.
The SAVE Act passed recently, requiring people to show proof of citizenship when registering to vote. You've shown your support for it in a statement.
Yeah.
Why do you support it?
Well, this is something that I think should be very clear. I mean, if you're not a citizen, you shouldn't be able to vote. And, you know, there were provisions that were made for somebody that may have recently gotten married, changed the name and all those things. I think it's a great bill. I mean, it's passed before and we passed it again. So I think voters need to make sure that the election process is secure. And I think the SAVE Act is one step in the right direction. So that's why I supported it. And I supported it the last time it came up before the House. And so I think it's a very good bill.
Sounds like there's a lot of concern, though, about what you mentioned, whether people would find it difficult to register if they are married and they've changed their names. And
there are provisions in there that made sure that wouldn't happen. So I mean, again, if anybody has any problems, they can reach out to our office. But there were provisions within the legislation that made sure that wouldn't happen.
On April 1st, Congressman Kerry joined one Republican and two Democratic lawmakers in introducing the CARE Act. It would allow seniors on Medicare to receive at-home emergency medical treatment for minor incidents without having to go to the emergency room.
Why do you think that's important?
Well, listen, I think you got to provide for our seniors and got to give them the best tools that they possibly can. You don't want them to have to just go to an emergency room. So this has seemed... to be honest with you, I couldn't believe that this wasn't in place, to be honest with you. And so this is something that we've working bipartisanly, allow our seniors to have the opportunity to not just have to go to the emergency room. So, again, I think it's a bipartisan bill. Can't believe that we're having to do it now. I thought it should have been done years ago.
Is this about saving them money or saving Medicare money for not having to take those trips?
No, I think it's just about giving seniors a better opportunity for care instead of having to just go to an emergency room.
Representative Kerry is also a co-sponsor of the bipartisan Credit for Caring Act. It would provide a tax credit of up to $5,000 for working family caregivers.
You know, when you have somebody that's at home, the expenses that you incur, a lot of people don't realize that. I mean, you want to be able to keep your loved one at home as much as possible. It gives them just a little wiggle room. And that's why the AARP is 100% supportive of it. It's something, again, I know 5,000 doesn't do everything, but it helps. And we want to have people to be able to be at home with their loved ones, providing that care.
And Congressman Kerry says they'll be able to focus more on those bills after the budget negotiations. Columbus Mayor Andrew Ginther gave his State of the City address Wednesday night. He focused on several topics, including housing and public safety. 10TV's Carly Dion breaks down the highlights of the mayor's message and what community members are saying about progress and challenges in the city.
If you ask Columbus Mayor Andrew Ginther, he'll tell you the state of the city is strong and growing rapidly. And those in attendance believe the future of the city is full of opportunities. The American dream, something many are struggling to attain when the cost of nearly everything has gone up, making it difficult to achieve goals like owning a home, something Mayor Ginther hopes to help.
Consider the numbers. From 2010 to 2020, our region built one new home for every 2.5 jobs that we created.
Ginther's goal moving forward is to create at least one house for every new job created in the region. Over the next 10 years, he says 200,000 housing units need to be created just to meet demand. He pledged Columbus to bring 100,000 of them to the market. Ginther also calling on voters to help, proposing a $500 million bond on the ballot to support affordable housing. Another challenge the community continues to address is public safety. But Ginther says significant efforts were made to reduce crime last year.
Homicides dropped by 17%. Felonious assaults were down 25%.
While the city sees some success in some areas, the data shows domestic violence cases are increasing. Ginther says it will take a community effort to address this problem. But Ginther says the Office of Violence Prevention is working on new initiatives in partnership with shelters to find solutions.
That was Carly Dion reporting. Toward the end of his speech, Mayor Ginther also announced his goal of making Columbus the nation's capital for women's sports and inspiring more young girls to get involved with sports in the community.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.